chapter 11 and 12.
Yeah.
So chapter 11, the lion roars. To catch us back up with where we are, there is only one person who can currently see Aslan. And that's Lucy. Lucy the Valiant. Lucy the Pure of Heart. And she has tried to convince the other kids that Aslan is here, but they don't see her and they do not believe her. There's, I think, very little malice in their lack of belief in Lucy. I think it's more of they want to see Aslan too, and that, and they're assuming that Lucy, you know, her heart is getting ahead of her head. You know, her desire is manifesting something that's not there. They don't blame her, but they're also not going to follow her because that just wouldn't be sensible. There's been a lot of talk about what makes the most sense, what's most practical, and so they went this one direction, found out it was much harder than they thought it would be. The geography had changed, the topography had changed, and by the time they actually got down to where they thought they could cross the river and join with Caspian, they ran right into guards and sentinels of Myraz's group, who shot arrows and would have overwhelmed them, so they had to backtrack all that miserable way. There's a little lesson in this for all of us, that when we strike out on our own, be prepared for it to be unsuccessful,
yeah.
And be prepared that the steps we have taken in that direction just might have to be backtracked. However far you've gone might just be how far you have to come back. How much time and effort would they have saved had they listened in the beginning? We won't know, and neither will they. No one has told that story of what would have happened. All right, so Lucy has now seen Aslan again and spoken with Aslan. She feels strong now like a lioness because he has breathed on her. She has spent time with him. She's even seen that the trees are starting to wake because they're around Aslan. And Aslan gives her a job. What's the job?
To convince the
others. Right? And if they will not be convinced, what's her job?
Just go with me.
That's all right. Come anyway. Though none will follow. So your job is to follow. Lead the others. And if they won't come, you just come yourself then. So
Barton, interesting, who was most willing.
Well, right. And
he thought she was the only one.
So the one person that she's able to, well, actually the first person she wakes up, or, and that's not true. At least she tries to wake up a couple of them, like, yeah, let's go. But when she wakes up one person, this person says, yes. Who is it?
Edmund.
Edmund the Just. Edmund, if anyone, who both knows what it's like to disbelieve his sister and be wrong.
Yeah.
Edmund, if anyone, knows what it's like to be forgiven and redeemed by Aslan. So, Edmund hops up. Is he happy and chipper to be on the way with Lucy? No, he's still very frustrated that he wants to go to sleep. But he is willing to do it because he knows it's the right thing. So, that brings us into chapter 11. And she starts waking everybody up. And how does she explain to them what's going on?
She just tells them. She's going to follow him. She invites them to come, and they're saying no. And she said, but I'm going anyway, even if you don't.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Can the other children see Aslan yet?
No.
And what is their response to her saying, well, I'm going to go even if you don't?
Edmund says he'll go with her.
That's right.
And Susan is downright snippy.
Oh, yeah. Susan.
Very much so.
Very much so.
Bad. Susan is kind of ugly here. You know, really kind of critiquing and chastising Lucy. This is being naughty.
Yeah, you need to go back to Susan.
That's right. Like, this is manipulative. What is Trumpkin's point of view?
Well, he doesn't really care for it.
Okay.
He's going to go
that's right. Remember, Trumpkin is the pragmatist. He wants things to make sense. Does he believe in Aslan?
No.
Not at all.
No, he doesn't.
Not at all.
Not even
a little bit. But he does believe in the High King. He has been convinced of that. And once he's convinced, he's convinced. He is an honest skeptic. He is no longer a skeptic of the High King, but he has no use for Aslan. But if the High King goes, I go. And I think we should all go.
Yeah.
Finally, Peter gets him going.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so off they go. And how does this trip look? Is it obvious, easy, and safe?
No.
So describe the trip.
They walk along the edge of the gorge.
Yeah,
and then they go down a real deep, steep, narrow path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's dark.
Yeah, it's still dark.
It's only lit by moonlight, and everybody agrees the moonlight is tricky to see in. And how do they know where to go?
They're
following Lucy. And how does Lucy know where to go?
She's following
Aslan.
Aslan disappears, and she thought he fell down in the gorge.
Well, as they are able to see where they're going, it's pretty treacherous looking. And maybe you're one of those people who have gone out to a high place, or you've crossed a bridge or something like that, and you know, just look forward, don't look down, don't look down, don't look down.
Right.
What happens when you look down?
You get scared.
You see what's there.
Yeah.
You have to lose your balance when you do things like that.
Yeah. Right, and so you look straight ahead. Have you ever seen anyone do a practical joke by blindfolding someone and putting them on a beam that's like on the ground or something, and they you're 10 feet off the ground, and you know, the person is they're really kind of freaking out, but it turns out they're
right there.
So it's not about the safety of the step. It's about the consequence of the fall.
Yeah, right.
That's what makes us so nervous. And when we're nervous, we panic. We lose control. And we lose control in a dangerous situation, that's when we fall. With everything that could be distracting Lucy, with the gorge and the slippery rocks and everything else, how does she keep her footing?
She knows that she's looking at Aslan.
She focuses on Aslan.
Yeah.
And his happy eyes.
To
yeah.
Turn and look at her with his happy eyes.
You know, if last week's hymn was "Though none will follow, I will go," and I've decided to follow Jesus, then this one seems more like "Turn your eyes upon Jesus." Turn your eyes upon Jesus. You know, just that sense of seeing the face of Christ and letting everything else fade away. That's how she's able to lead them. Now, the kids don't see Aslan, so they're trusting Lucy and they're following Lucy. What starts to happen little by little?
They start to see. About a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. He says, "What is that?" And she said, "Aslan, shadow."
Okay.
And he said, "Where's Aslan?" And then he saw him.
All right.
She says he's right there.
He's right there.
Within the shadow.
And
then he becomes more and more clear to Edmund.
Yes.
And then he becomes clearer to the others.
Exactly. Little by little, everyone starts to see him.
Except Susan takes her forever.
Well, it does and it doesn't.
Yeah.
At the very end,
she admits
and she apologizes.
Yeah.
She was sulking. And that's a kind of a little warning. When you sulk, you have the tendency to say and do something you know that you shouldn't, but it just feels so right in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to introduce a concept here, because C.S. Lewis is so great at sliding in these elements of profound faith under very simple circumstances. What do you make of the children being able to see Aslan little by little?
That's how God unpeels us. Well, I've heard it. It's an unpeeling an onion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God brings us closer and closer to Him but it's never today we're here and tomorrow we're over there. It's always a little by little. He grows our faith and he shows us more of his face.
Right. The more you trust and follow, the more you see and understand. So this is the maxim of Saint Anselm. Fides quorum intellectum. Faith seeking understanding. We have a tendency to approach faith as something to understand and then believe. You know, Trumpkin wants seeing is believing for Trumpkin.
Yes.
You know, all of these are crazy stories until you can prove it to me. Now, once you prove it to me, I'm on your side. But that is understanding seeking faith. I have to understand it first, and then once I understand it, I will believe. And St. Anselm says it actually works the other way around. You must believe in order to understand.
Yeah, right.
That you, the more you trust, the deeper you will come to know. Now, that seems counterintuitive until we apply it under circumstances that we are familiar with. Okay? You can talk all you want to about falling in love. You can read books. You can watch movies. You can get opinions from others. You can sit and ponder it and write in your diary about the feelings of love, but you will not understand it until you experience it. So what Anselm is getting to is that experiential nature of faith. You have to trust the Lord for some things that you will then come to understand because you trust. Sometimes you have to take that step before you can see what's in front of you. And it feels counterintuitive. It feels like it's not the smart way to go or the sensible way to go. And we can have a lot of kind of intuitive respect for Trumpkin, wanting, you know, seeing is believing, and I don't want to fall off a cliff. But at the same time, had they not simply trusted, they never would have made it down. Are there circumstances that you could think of or that you've experienced that you just kind of had to take someone by the hand and trust them? You couldn't really wrap your head around it. It couldn't really be laid out in a systematic, sequential fashion. But once you're in the middle of it or at the end of it, then you understand. It's not unlike, a sick and hurting child. You know, when our kids get sick or when they've been hurt. And sometimes you have to do things with them or to them that they don't want.
Yes, definitely.
But it's going to be good for them. Anyone ever, and I mean, the whole getting a shot of the doctor, that's kind of an obvious one, but I'll tell you a miserable one for me. Anyone ever have their child with a super high fever and you had to put them in the bathtub?
Yeah.
Like, you even call the doctor, and the doctor's like, get that temperature down now. Have you ever had to do that?
No.
I have. It was done to me when I was a kid, and I've had to do that too. And it's the worst thing, because even lukewarm water, when you've got a temperature of 105,
feels
freezing, and they're already miserable, and they're
yeah.
And you have to,
just really,
you know, it's horrible. Yeah. I mean, you want to cry as you're doing this. You feel like you're torturing them. They don't understand.
And you can't explain it.
And whether it's taking your medicine because it tastes bad, whether it's getting a shot at the doctor because it's going to hurt, some of these things you cannot rationalize in advance. You can only see in retrospect. I have to trust you enough to let this happen. And once it's done, then I will see. I'm not saying that all of life is like that, but that is one of the mysteries of faith. Can you have understanding and faith first? I would say yes, because that's Lewis's own story. You know, he was really confronted with the logic of God And then that logic brought him to faith, a faith that he was very frustrated with. He didn't want it, but he kind of used it on a skeptic, and so once he was convinced, he was convinced. But the perspective of St. Anselm is that growing in faith, that discipleship, the cart and the horse are different than we expect. And in the proper order, it's a little like love. The more you love someone like your spouse or your child, the more you will know them. And you can't know certain things about them until you love them. But in that love, that's when certain secrets are open. That's when certain intimacies are revealed. That's when certain moments can be observed that wouldn't happen the opposite way. And so, I think that's part of the reason why the children have to follow Lucy, who is keeping her eyes on Aslan, and little by little, the more they follow, the more they see. They'd seen from the beginning, maybe that would have made everything easier, but it also would not have taught them much. so, this is a subtle point, but I think it's an important one. Fides horens intellectum. And the deeper our faith, the more we want to know.
And some people have to go the other way. Right?
It's true. And it's true. Again, like C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. But by and large, those people who go the other way find a moment where that shifts. I understand, therefore I will believe, but in my belief I want to know more. Okay, how are we so far?
Good.
Okay.
I like what happened when Peter and Edmund talked with Aslan. And he said to them, you have been listening to fear, here let me breathe on you.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, similar to Lucy, but this sense that, you know, and I can't help but be reminded of Jesus and the disciples in the upper room. He breathes on them. They receive the Holy Spirit and they feel stronger and the church is built. I remember that when Lucy and Aslan speak in the previous chapter and she says, you know, oh, well, what, you know, how could I have made them come with me? There's no way. I'm kind of like I'm not to blame. And Aslan doesn't let her off the hook. He didn't say anything. He doesn't, you know, smush her for it. But he just quietly allows her to realize and admit, well, I guess I could have if I tried, but I didn't. Peter, when he finally sees Aslan and they have come to the clearing, repents, asks for forgiveness. You know, he kneels down, he takes Aslan's paw, I am so sorry, I've been leading them wrong. And Aslan's response is quite simply, my dear son. It's restoration, boom, just like that. And this does my heart good. How does Aslan receive Edmund? Well done. Edmund, who has had so many times where he has not done well, and now he is truly Edmund the Just, where though none would easily and readily follow Lucy, he was once who said, even though I don't get it, I will.
Yeah.
And that answer is simply, well done. Well done. What happens with Aslan and Susan, who was kind of the most difficult?
She's the one listening to fears.
Yes.
Right, Susan.
And the breath makes her braver.
Yeah.
And so there is a, you know, more purposeful restoration here. The others aren't breathed on like she is. Maybe she needs a little something extra. Now, to deal with Trumpkin, the pragmatist who has to see to believe. How does that go?
Picks it up like a technician. shake it.
Yeah, he picks him up like a cat.
With a little bit of a roar, just enough to probably make him pee his dwarf pants.
Yeah.
And Aslan grabs him and shakes him and throws him up in the air.
And catches
really
him.
As terrifying as he can be, but all within the context of great safety and care. And catches him and
catches
with all his paws and, you know, shall we be friends? And yes. So this is just, again, it's a little bit of a formality, but it's a nice touch. If Peter and Edmund are understood as sons of Adam, Trumpkin is a son of
the earth.
The dwarves and humans are not the same. It is you know, kind of a respectful title. It's a title of his origin, you know, son of Earth. And it is now time, with everyone on board, with everyone having seen Aslan and strengthened by him, now it's time to get some work done. So they split up. Who goes where?
Peter and Edmund and Trumpkin go to the mound.
They go to Aslan's house because they need to meet up with Caspian. And where do the girls go? With Aslan. They're there in the woods.
Why do you think the girls, the women, mm-hmm. always are with him?
I'll give you two guesses. It's speculation, but I think it's not unfounded. It's two things. Number one, we already know that C.S. Lewis does not like warfare. It's not a romantic, heroic thing. Even though there is heroism, it's still ugly. And so it's not overly romanticized. The other thing, he even mentions that when, Lewis mentions it through Father Christmas when Lucy receives a dagger, just like Susan getting her arrow, that battles are ugly things when women are involved. And we talked about that in the last book, that...
Yeah.
You know, part of it is chivalry, but also just in that sense of for women to be involved in warfare gives you the impression we are now in a state of total war, where the elderly and infirm and the children are given sticks.
At the women and children.
Yeah, it's terrible. Like you're at the most dire and desperate of need when your average population takes their pitchforks and stands against the rolling tanks. Like that's when it's do or die. But here's the other thing. I think it's also looking towards the biblical example of the women who are there at the cross, who are there at the resurrection, who anoint him prior to the cross and seek to anoint him after his death. That there is a fellowship that the women have with Jesus that is very tender and very close. I think of Martha Mary, and I think of Mary of Bethany, who sits at the feet of Jesus and weeps and wipes his feet with her hair and anoints him with the nard, this fragrant perfume, prior to Maundy Thursday. That's kind of what I see in Susan and Lucy having a different. You know, not unlike Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Peter and Edmund are off fighting in the battle, and Lucy and Susan are there with Aslan as he dies and he is resurrected.
And Mary Magdalene was like Lucy when he was saying he's not here.
That's right. That's
and
right. They are the only ones there at the cross, or at least for the most part, the men have deserted them. Have deserted Christ. Apparently, at least John is there because you know Jesus says. You know, to John and to his mother, behold your son, and work that out. But they're there at the end, mm-hmm. and they're there at the beginning. I think that's maybe a connection that he's trying to highlight. All right, so this chapter ends with Aslan and the girls, Susan and Lucy, and what's going on? Because this is kind of weird.
Party time.
It's a party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The trees move.
The trees are
okay, so the trees and the spirits of the water and the wells and the streams and all of creation is now alive again. Why is it alive again?
Probably because they've all come together with Aslan.
Aslan is the reason. Even before this moment, remember Lucy can see the trees starting to come alive, but they only really seem alive when they're close to him. And now he is there kind of fully, and they are fully awake. And so we meet a couple of mythological characters. The young wild boy is?
Oh, yes.
Bacchus. Okay? So Bacchus. And the girls are the Maenads and Old Silenus. So these are from Greek and Roman mythology. Bacchus is the god of wine, merriment. And the Maenads were women who followed him around. It's where we get the term maniac, because they were crazy and they were wild. These were women who were, at least the myths, were so wild in ecstasy and drunkenness that they were known to rip people apart. And even Bacchus, you know, this is, in the mythology, not just a benign sense of, you know, a little dinner aperitif, but, you know, wanton drunkenness. And, you know, Old Silenus was basically a drunkard, and, you know, so.
They did drink a lot.
Makes sense of why they're there with Aslan. Any thoughts?
Well, Lucy says that she wouldn't have felt safe if Aslan hadn't been there.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So this is something that I think Lewis is pointing to. It's subtle, but it's important. He is bringing in the old myths. You know, whether it was the last book and you know, dwarfs and fauns and even Father Christmas, or in this myth, where he's bringing in, you know, Bacchus and the Maenads and Old Silenus, he is bringing in these old myths, these old pagan thoughts, but he is doing so within the context of Aslan. So, not on their own. On their own, by themselves, as pagan myths, they're dangerous. They're dangerous. But seen through the lens of Aslan, with him there, now we're safe.
That's neat, because in my journey, I've been to things, spiritual things and stuff that didn't work, but I have prayed that the Holy Spirit and Jesus keeps me safe.
Yeah.
And
see
this.
So basically he's bringing these myths in as good things because of Aslan. Without Aslan, they would be untrustworthy and potentially very dangerous.
Yes.
But through Aslan, even the old myths and what is about them that's true can be experienced and enjoyed, because through Aslan they are safe. They've been tamed, in essence. You know, we get only kind of the nice parts. You know, there are nice parts of wine, and there are terrible parts of wine. There are nice parts of drinking, and there are very dangerous parts of drinking.
Yes, there are.
And so, what he is doing, he's kind of bringing all of these things in, and through Christ, through Aslan, these are okay. And now even the myths, the stuff in the myths that were true or that pointed to something within humanity that desires something deeper and bigger and broader than itself, it's not dismissed out of hand, but it's brought into its proper context, where the fullness of what we hope for, Romans or Greeks for Americans is found in Christ. This is Paul at Mars Hill saying, "O men of Athens, I see you are religious in many ways. You even have an altar to an unknown God. What is not known to you, I make known to you. It is Jesus Christ who has made the heavens and the earth." So even kind of the crazy stuff like Bacchus is now sort of baptized and brought into Narnia and can be trustworthy, not in and of themselves, but through Aslan. They are not his peers, they are his servants.
When I read that, it reminded me of life before I really started studying the Bible. And I remember after I started studying the Bible and all of a sudden I realized God's been there helping me all along, but I never realized it before.
Right. And now you can see it more clearly. So the next chapter, and these kind of flow together because they're happening, roughly simultaneously as the girls are with the romp going on in the forest, growing vines and grapes that surpass all. The boys have now made it into Aslan's Howl. So they get pretty far in before somebody stops them. And they even make note of that. I don't know if Peter Redman basically says that, our side isn't keeping a very good watch for us to get so far in before being challenged. What does that make you think? I think there's a hint to how things are going.
Not well.
I mean, maybe they've lost people. Maybe they are all wounded or beaten up. But the fact that they can get so far in is, I think it's sort of alluding to this army is kind of on its last legs, maybe. And so, who finally stops them? A pair of badgers. Trumkin announces himself, and he announces the High King, and how do the badgers greet Peter Nevin?
They're
not
hiding.
Peter hugs him.
They kind of snuffle their hands and just, I loved this, finally. That's all they said, finally. And I find a beauty in that. There is an expectation to say finally. Not, what? The High King? Crazy! No, instead it was, we've been waiting for so long, but I knew you wouldn't let us down. Finally. So they get a little deeper in, and they realize that there are voices holding counsel.
Can we run back just a little bit to when Peter whispers to Edmund, look at those carvings on the walls. Don't they look old? And yet we're older than that.
Correct.
What is the significance of that? Or is
I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure. I think it's maybe just one of those mysterious things where whether we in Narnia we want to call it magic or whether here we want to call it a holy mystery, that there are some things of God that are beyond our understanding.
And they were made after, like he says, when we were last here, they hadn't been made.
Exactly, and yet they feel ancient compared to, and it's just a weird feeling. And I think it's just sort of, it's definitely pointing to the passage of time, and it's underscoring it's been a long, long time. But I also think it's sort of in there to just have that air of holy mystery.
I wonder if it was something that he might come back to later.
Not really. No. Not really. If we ever get to a point, and there's another one that I may mention if somebody brings it up, and I'll tell you, don't worry about it. But I think it's just a matter of, just how big and how mysterious this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just can't grasp everything.
Because he says it makes you think.
Makes you think.
Yeah.
Okay. So they kind of hold themselves outside of this room to hear what's going on. And they hear some rather heated voices, but these are voices in council. Who is there talking?
Nick
of Brit,
Caspian,
Cornelius, and Truffle Hunter. Okay, so the original kind of inner circle, except for Trumpkin, they are kind of holding council. And what are they talking about?
The horn having been blown.
Their despair.
Their despair. I think that's the best way to put it. They blew the horn. The horn that never fails. That came with the promise of that, you know, help will come. Where's the help?
They haven't seen it yet.
Now,
but Trufflehunter says, have patience.
Trufflehunter says, you know, they could be right outside the doorway. Which they are. But that's not much help right now. Why is it not much help for somebody to say patient?
They don't. All they can see is what's been happening.
And what's been happening?
They've all been killed.
The war's going very badly. It's going very badly. They already waited until things were going badly before they blew the horn. Remember, they had this whole debate, when should we blow it? Should we blow it now, or should we wait till our hour of uttermost need?
Yes.
And they say, go ahead and blow it now, because you don't want to get to the point where it's so bad it doesn't help. But that also kind of points to, it's pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And apparently, since they've blown it, it's gotten worse. What are some of the things that's happened since they've blown it?
Well, the dwarves, most of them have died.
Well, at least some of them have.
And was it the badgers also that had died? There was another group.
No, I think you're thinking about something that's going
to
happen a little bit later. We'll talk about that in a second.
Maybe I
could So there's definitely been some battles and some skirmishes. They've been on the bad side of it every time. They keep running. They're running even lower on food than they were. Everyone is miserable. And people are leaving. Why are people leaving?
Because they've lost faith.
They've lost faith. Why?
Because the war is going badly and they don't have food. And
yeah.
They've got miserable circumstances.
They expected.
But someone let the cat out of the bag about what that horn was all about. And so, if you remember, Trumpkin's advice was, don't tell anybody. We don't want the enemy to know, and we don't even want our own people to know. Because if nothing happens, no one's the wiser. Don't get their hopes up. Well, word must have gotten out, and then when there wasn't an immediate response, now the despair has really set in. And so we have people who are abandoning. And they seem to be at their absolute lowest. And what happens within a group when you are at your absolute lowest?
They argue.
You argue, you fight, you bring up old problems, and you know, remember that time 15 years ago when you poked me and you looked funny at me? Well, I haven't forgotten. And, you know, to be at your wit's end, to be just kind of a raw nerve, means that everything is wrong, and you are remembering every past offense, and you are... You look funny, and I'm sick of the way you smell. Everything is just rotten. So what is... Let's hit our players real quick. We've already said the Truffle Hunter's perspective is be patient. We animals are patient. What is... what's Dr. Cornelius's perspective?
He thought he was patient also, but he's, I don't know what he is.
Yeah, I think he's just confused. He doesn't understand.
Well,
he's disappointed, but he doesn't understand. Like, I really thought this would work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
What about Caspian? What's Caspian's
perspective? He doesn't really know. He's kind of... I've heard the stories, but maybe they're not true.
I think Caspian is doing his best to stay faithful, but he doesn't have any answers left. You know,
because he's not had any experience.
Well, and this horn was going to be the answer, and I trust Dr. Cornelius, and if he's confused, I don't know any better than that. What about Nicobrick?
Oh, he's totally...
I have a solution. We're going to bring in the witch.
All right.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Make
okay.
a Brick has
yes.
had enough.
Yeah.
Enough is enough is enough is enough.
Yeah.
My people, the dwarves, we've suffered the greatest losses. We have put up with the most hardship. And I have been more than patient with all of you fools. But enough is enough. And I've got a plan. And part of that plan is to introduce people that he has brought with them. Who are these two people?
Hag.
Okay. He has found a hag somewhere.
Hag
meaning like a witch.
Yeah.
She introduces herself by, you know, kind of being real smarmy with Dr. Cornelius and saying she has just a you know, the barest touch of magic.
Yeah, right.
And
I'm a poor old lady.
Right.
Yeah.
And who is the other companion?
Well, he's a werewolf, but he doesn't get introduced as that.
No, what is his introduction? It's pretty creepy.
Gray and
he has this little monologue about, you know, when I bite, I never let go, and you'll have to cut the flesh from my mouth, and I can drink a river of blood, and show me your enemies, and whoa, so what is Nicabrick's real plan here?
The White Witch.
The White Witch.
The White Witch, yeah.
Okay. The hag and the werewolf and Nicabrick are convinced that they can summon the spirit of the White Witch. That black magic.
Witch defeated Alakazam.
Well, at this point, when the three other members of the council protest about how evil the White Witch is, and you know you're setting yourself up against Aslan if you go on her side, what's Nicabrick's response?
Well, she killed him.
Killed
him. And maybe he never did come alive again.
That's right.
What has he done since? We haven't heard anything.
Exactly right. And you want power? You think you need power to help yourself? How about the power to turn it always winter and never Christmas? 100 years of ice and snow. That's power that can take care of my rats.
Yeah, but he's dead with kings and queens.
So, in his despair, but despair that has now turned to anger, his bitter anger, Nicabrick has utterly rejected Aslan and has aligned himself with the White Witch. Really, we've described that little spectrum of Truffle Hunter Trumpkin and Nicabrick. Truffle Hunter faithful, Trumpkin pragmatist, show me and I'll believe if it makes sense, and Nicabrick the utilitarian. I will use whatever is useful. He is now blaspheming. He is willing to condemn himself just for the chance of revenge. Whoever has the power, I will align myself with anyone. And what is the result of this plan?
Well, the fight begins, and I wasn't sure whether the Edmund and Peter and Trumpkin comes in during this, but the badger, no, the wolf is killed, and the queen is killed, and Knickerbocker is killed.
Yes. So. So he lays out this plan to the horror of the other members of the council, and then the hag starts. I'm going to draw the circle and light the blue fire. Here comes the black magic right now, and that's when the boys from Trumpkin rush in. That's when Truffle Hunter and Caspian charge the hag and the werewolf, and it's just a mess everywhere. So it's confusion, and it's a fight, and it's, you know, we've got the hag who's about to murder Dr. Cornelius. We've got the werewolf attacking Caspian. We've got, Edmund thinks he's fighting Nicabrick.
It was the queen that attacked Caspian, wasn't it? Didn't she take him by
the hag? No, the hag has gotten Cornelius.
She's
right.
The hag.
Yeah. We never see the White Witch. They start the incantation or they start the spell, but it never goes anywhere.
That's right.
So you know, the haggis gets her head cut off, and Cassian manages to kill the werewolf, or somebody helps him. And it's all confusion at this point. It's all confusion. As a matter of fact, Edmund thinks he's sitting on top of Knickerbrick, and he's actually sitting on top of Trumpkin.
Yeah.
Trumpkin's managed to be on the bottom.
Yeah.
So, and again, there's an air of reality to this. You know, oh, the heroic sword fight, which looks like fencing, and where everyone is, you know, kind of paired off with, you know, one valiant victor versus the one, you know, sniveling villain, and instead, it's just a mess. Mm-hmm. Remember way back in the first book, when Peter has his first fight against the wolf, and he pulls out his sword, and the wolf is on top of him, and it's just like, it's all hair and fur and heat and blood, and it's just, even this moment, there is a reality to the battle where it's confusing, and it's desperate. And it's just a mess for a few minutes, but then it's all over. So remember, C.S. Lewis fought in the trenches. He knows. He knows that battles are not clean and happy and glorious, but the battles themselves can be quite ugly and quite confusing and just be a mess. So what's the end result here?
The hag's dead.
Hag's dead. Werewolf is dead. Half transformed, but now dead. And who else is dead?
Knickerbrick.
So there is a brief greeting. The High King and Caspian. The High King. You know, I'm not here to take your place. I'm here to put you on your place.
Yeah.
They're very glad to see one another, and they. They need to figure out what to do with the bodies. What is the decision made?
Let the birdlings
out. Okay. The hag and the werewolf will be thrown into the pit.
Yeah.
This is wicked. This is rank wickedness. And we are not going to honor that. But Knickerbrick. To be buried with honor. We hate what happened to him. We acknowledge that he died, and he had to at this point. But there's an understanding that he was an ally. And he was just kind of too eaten up from the inside out, though.
Was that like Judas?
I don't see Knickerbrick like Judas so much as I see him. See, with Judas, I think you get the element of personal knowledge. I was a disciple, and then I turned. And I think for Knickerbrick, you get, I think this is more of, I don't know.
It's like the person that has faith and is walking with the Lord, and then something bad happens to them, and they lose faith. And they may come back to faith, you know, as you read on in the stories and such, but he dies before he comes back to faith.
Well, it said that he'd gone sour inside.
Yeah.
Long suffering.
I kind of see him as a kind of the quote-unquote good person who maybe comes to church on Christmas and Easter. Their faith is a very ancillary thing. They might have very little faith, but they try to live a good moral life. But something has happened to them. And you know, they've had an unspeakable tragedy. We know people like this, where someone maybe has died, a husband or a wife, the death of a child.
The death of a father that you adore.
When a child, like a minor child dies, the statistics are through the roof that marriage will end. And it normally has to do with not being able to see the spouse without remembering the pain. And those marriages often, very often, dissolve because they are now so broken on the inside. That's kind of where I see Knickerbrick in this is, you know, he could have been a great guy. But something happened along the way, and he never recovered. And that sickness was always in him, and eventually consumed him. To give an example in history that would be after Lewis but before now, I would liken him to the this happened several times, especially in South America, where the church would be aligned with the communists against, like, the ruling dictator or whatever, and they had a common enemy, and they could work together until they didn't. And by and large, the communists would turn on the church after they dealt with the dictator. We don't really have any use for you either. And the Christians who try to be Christians and communists eventually just became straight communists, because the battle itself was so important and victory was so necessary that eventually, if the call of Christ is for me to lay down my arms, I will not do that. So Nick of Brick, I think, is that person who, like they talk about the rotten tree. You don't even realize how bad it is on the inside. But when the storm comes, it falls. After the hurricane,
yeah,
and we had all these big trees down, I would drive around sometimes and see this big, beautiful tree, and it's a huge hole in the middle of the trunk that you would not have noticed. There's no way to know how fragile it actually was. It would have looked solid as a rock, but when enough wind came, the rottenness on the inside brought the whole thing down.
That's kind of what happens to people.
I mean, I think this is true. I think this is real. A tragedy they just cannot get past, and eventually it just, you know, their whole life is sort of soured. When you read stories about people who, their child was murdered or something, and they forgive the offender, how noteworthy that is. You're like, oh, it's so amazing that someone could, I don't know that I could do that. But then you see in other circumstances, and the parents who are just so angry that they will never get past this moment, and they want the perpetrator to just suffer and die and burn, and they will suffer with him for the rest of their lives.
Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah.
Somebody said something, I can't even remember who it was now, this last week, said it was a person that was bitter about something, and the person speaking to me said, "Isn't she a Christian?" And I said, "Yes, I think she is." Then we had a little conversation about, even though you're a Christian, you can have that kind of anger and hate. And the only thing you do for those people is to pray for them.
Well, and it's a real temptation.
But the forgiveness is, I mean, that saying is true. Many times I've forgiven because I can't take the other.
Yeah.
I would have to be released that,
right,
to be made whole and to be at peace. I can't have that anymore.
By releasing the other person, you are released yourself.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's kind of selfish in a way.
Otherwise, you would carry that.
Right.
For,
yes.
And again, Nick of Brick succumbs. Not because he's the worst dwarf ever, but because he could not get past it, and eventually it ate him.
Yeah.
And so the choice to have him buried with the dwarves in honor is to kind of acknowledge that. We wish this had turned out differently. Now, the hag and the werewolf, they were just wicked. But with Nick of Brick, we really wish this would have worked out. But ultimately, he could not get past himself. But may he be laid to rest in honor by his people, because it's right.
And that's some compassion there.
Absolutely.
Mercy.
All right, and that's where we are. They are together, but it's not like they've won any battles against Myraz.
No.
They've only just met and kind of saved their own skins.
Yeah.
So we've got
three
chapters. I don't know how we want to do that. Do we want to do two and one, or do we just want to do three?
Why don't we do three?
Do you think it's too much to do three, or should we do three?
Yeah.
And get everything
you know
we
about
need
to get out of it.
I say let's do two and one,
okay.
And that way it's gonna bring us a little bit
closer
to Easter, Holy Week, and that way we won't be taking quite as long of a break.
Okay.
So we'll stop there. And we'll do two chapters for next week.
Okay.
Okay.